Hi, it's Josh Barrow. Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and I recorded this episode of Left, Right, and Center on the afternoon of Friday, January 31st, as the Senate debated witnesses in the impeachment inquiry. We finished recording the show before all the votes were done, although we had some indications of where they were going. So please be advised that some of what you hear in this episode may not reflect everything that has happened, but we will be back on Friday, February 7th, to discuss more. This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the last week of January, and as we tape on Friday afternoon, the Senate trial of President Donald Trump appears to be drawing to a close. Senator Lamar Alexander announced late Thursday that he would oppose having the Senate interview witnesses of its own. The key question here was about John Bolton. Would he be called to testify about why the president withheld congressionally appropriated military aid to Ukraine? But Senator Alexander said it's already been proved that the president did that, and that he did so inappropriately to press Ukraine for investigations related to Joe Biden, his political rival. This was inappropriate, Alexander emphasized. But it doesn't meet the Constitution's bar for removing a president from office, he said. So Alexander intends to vote against witnesses and against removal. Republican Senators Mitt Romney and Susan Collins had been pushing for witnesses, but without Alexander, they likely do not have the votes to get them, and that means we expect the trial to end with an acquittal. Now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
Susan Hennessy also joins us for our discussion of impeachment. Susan is a senior fellow in national security law at the Brookings Institution and executive editor of the Lawfare blog. Hello, Susan.
Hi.
So, Susan, since we appear to be headed for an acquittal, my first question is, has this been a useful exercise? I mean, for example, former third-party candidate Evan McMullen was tweeting Friday morning, bemoaning the damage that he sees an acquittal doing to the country, saying that if Trump is acquitted, Congress loses power to check the president's effectively above the law, attacks on U.S. democracy are encouraged. It was clear from the beginning that the Republican-controlled Senate was not going to remove Trump. So was it a mistake to put him up for a trial that was clearly going to end with an acquittal all along?
So I think that's a little bit the wrong way to think about it, because I think we should consider it as a spectrum, with the worst outcome being not impeaching the president at all and essentially making this statement, but through inaction, that the president's conduct was not impeachable and not attempting to use the remedy, sort of an accountability remedy at all. Impeachment with acquittal is the second worst outcome. So I don't think that we should think about this as, well, maybe we shouldn't have attempted to impeach him at all, or Democrats shouldn't have attempted to impeach him at all. In the history of impeachment in the United States is the history of failed impeachment. It is the history of impeachment without removal. You know, that said, I don't think that we should ignore the long-term structural consequences, not just of an acquittal, but also the particular form of acquittal that we're seeing, which is really Republicans, and we see Lamar Alexander saying it out loud, sort of somewhat astonishingly, saying, yes, we believe that the president did this. We aren't making a comment on sort of narrow thresholds about burden of proof, but instead we are saying that this is acceptable conduct for the president of the United States to engage in. And that is something that is going to have long-term consequences, not just for the rest of this term of Trump's presidency and potentially a second term, but future presidents and the future of the presidency.
Yeah, Rich, I think the key word there from Susan is acceptable. It's not that Republicans necessarily think or are willing to say that what the president did was okay, although some of them are willing to say that. And you've seen a number of Republicans in Congress sort of picking up the, well, you know, gee, really, the Bidens did need to be investigated line. But when you see this statement from Alexander, it is effectively a statement that the president's behavior was acceptable in as much as he is accepting it. He's saying it was inappropriate, but really, this is a question for the voters. And I guess my question is, if a future Democrat president withholds duly appropriated foreign aid funds in order to pressure a foreign country to do him a political favor, is that going to be treated as acceptable by Republicans?
No, and I don't think it's fair to say Lamar is saying that it's acceptable. I think this gets to the crux of the matter, at least in one respect. Is any improper or unacceptable conduct, should it lead to impeachment or removal? Or is it a really high bar that's equivalent to, in the political context, a capital crime that must be punished with capital punishment? That's what you're asking the Senate to conclude. And what we'll likely have when the actual vote happens is the same thing we've had in every single other impeachment trial of a president in Senate. Only two other examples, but no member of the president's own party has ever voted to convict. So if the circumstances were reversed, I think partisan dynamics are such that Republicans would be outraged and pulling their hair out, and Democrats would be coming up with all sorts of defenses. And again, different set of facts, but you know, I go back to if the concern here is overweening executive power, there was not a peep of objection from center-left commentators, really, or Democrats in Congress over President Obama, in effect, unilaterally writing immigration law on his own. So if you really care about executive power as a matter of principle across all cases, you would say, oh, we support the policy and the goal, but the means are wrong. Even now, with Bernie Sanders saying he's going to, a huge part of his agenda now will be executive orders, Elizabeth Warren saying she's going to do much of her agenda unilaterally, there's basically very little criticism on the center left. At the same time, they're saying that Trump doing this, you know, tears at a very constitutional fabric. So I think Lamar's statement was good, and it's much closer to what I think Republicans should have been saying all along. It's proved he did it. It was wrong, inappropriate. You know, it's the mildest word you can apply, but it doesn't justify removing a president. And as a prudential concern, it does matter that there's an election really soon on the horizon here.
I would note sort of in response, you know, especially to Rich's observation that people who didn't have objections to President Obama's use of executive order or whether or not this reflects sort of a principled position on the scope of executive power. I actually think people, and I include myself in this category, who have advocated for a really robust and muscular executive have the highest responsibility to advocate for impeachment. And that really goes back to just the fundamental vision of the framers and this notion that they understood they were creating an astonishingly empowered executive. They were doing it intentionally. They were doing it cognizant of the risks because they believed that there was this check and that when a president abused and misused and motivation, of course, being core to that, you know, sort of whether or not he was undertaking action in his own interest or in the public interest, that impeachment is the remedy. And so I actually think the fundamental disconnect comes whenever people who advocate for strong executive power then shy away from impeachment. I think you have to embrace both the power and the constraint with equal force.
Liz, do you think these questions matter at this level of abstraction? I mean, because these sort of questions of which powers should belong to the legislative, which should belong to the president, and, you know, are they, is one usurping the other? It's something you hear a lot about from, you know, from aspects of the establishment on the center left, and it's something you hear a lot about, at least intermittently, from conservatives, although some of the conservatives who have said that stuff the loudest, I think, have not been really trying to hold Donald Trump accountable here. But it feels to me like it's not something that you hear a lot about from the left, and I'm wondering if that has to do with a different sense of what government is for, or the value of institutions for getting government to do the right things.
I think the left has a pretty jaundiced view of how principles end up meeting material reality. And how power actually operates. So, you know, it's worthwhile in a philosophical sense to have these conversations about what a liberal democracy ought to look like. The problem is that the gap between liberal democracy in theory and liberal democracy in practice has always been really, really, really wide, and it will likely remain so. There are, of course, theories on the left about why that is, you know, that the actual material practice of liberalism has more to do with being this kind of ideological bulwark of capitalism than actually establishing something like democracy on the ground. Of course, leftists feel like the only way to have a workable and free liberal democracy is to reduce the power that capital has in the economy and in the state. And so, you know, on that level, these are worthwhile conversations to have, you know, in terms of intellectual debate. I just think at this point, the left is focused on the election. It was always well known that impeachment is a political process. It was never likely that the Republican Senate was going to remove Trump. So this has been a fun exercise. But now we've got to win the election.
Do you think it's been a useful exercise?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Was anyone's mind changed in this process? I don't know. Did it bring down Trump's favorables and bump up his unfavorables? If that was the case in a lasting way, then that could be useful. My concern with impeachment and the shot at removal was always that a good number of voters would feel like it was undermining the political process and that they were being that their votes were being negated, essentially, and that would create legitimacy issues down the line. Since it doesn't appear that that's going to happen, he's not going to be removed, and therefore this likely won't be an impact, I think we've at least averted the worst possible impact. Have we really gained much? I don't know. I mean, it seems like everything that was known from the beginning is all we still know. And, you know, that was the narrow focus strategy.
Susan, what do you say to that? Because, I mean, I think this goes back to conversations, including that we had on this show back in the summer. Now, this was focused more on the Mueller report than on the subsequent revelations related to Ukraine. But I felt like a lot of the back and forth about, you know, whether impeachment is a worthwhile exercise, even if you know it's not going to lead to removal, has to do with the question of whether impeachment is some sort of accountability, whether it, you know, it acts as Rich describes it, as a super censure on the president, whether it acts on public opinion in some way, it acts as a check on the president's power, even if it doesn't remove him. And I guess the question is, has that happened here? In what manner has this impeachment process constituted accountability that is different from if Congress had not impeached the president at all?
Yeah, I think you have to separate out sort of the political ramifications and political consequences from the structural consequences, right? Sort of the impact on long-term interbranch function. And certainly this isn't to diminish the importance of the immediate political consequences, which of course are significant. But I do think that sort of the politics diminish over time. They become less and less salient, less and less important. And the structural consequences and the structural statements that are made through action and inaction become more and more important as time goes on. And we see that even now in this impeachment proceeding, to the extent to which we've gone back to look at prior impeachments, what were included in the articles, what precedent was being set. And so I think that everything Liz just said might be absolutely correct, sort of as a political matter. I tend to think that we also need to be taking a long-term view of it. And so before we were talking about this notion of whether or not Republicans were saying it was acceptable or not acceptable, maybe the appropriate word to use is tolerable or intolerable. And recalling that impeachment is a blunt instrument, right? It's an up or down vote here. And so, you know, I do think that the way to understand our current moment is the United States Congress as a body has determined that the actions that Donald Trump is accused of are impeachable actions. That's a message to future presidents, and that unfortunately the current remedy of impeachment is actually just the current remedy of conviction and removal is ultimately a raw vote count of how many members of the president's own party sit in the Senate at a particular time. And I'm heartened by sort of the front end of that. And I think that impeaching the president for this particular conduct was really, really important. And it does set an important boundary and constraint. That said, I think this notion that removal is not a genuine remedy, it's just a measurement of political power, that is going to have long-term consequences, especially if we don't see a reverse in sort of trends towards polarization, over the coming years.
I would say, as I think I've said from the beginning, the best case for what Democrats are doing is that it's a censure, and it's going to be on his record forever. And perhaps you can also make the case that they got more information more quickly with more public attention to it. Running it through an impeachment inquiry rather than a standard committee investigation. That might be true, too. But the prudential calculation is always, and Liz was hitting on this, you're going to have to elect someone else president. And I think whether impeachment was a good idea or not for Democrats' purposes rises and falls on the question of whether it's helped there or not. I think there's some marginal indication that impeachment may have helped President Trump, at least in this interim. He seems to have a little more polling momentum, although he never really moves much off his numbers. But because that's the ultimate accountability, is the public electing him from office, the calculation whether this made sense, I think, has to do largely with that.
Another odd thing about this process is that it's ending with Chekhov's gun not going off, which is to say we don't seem like we're actually going to hear from John Bolton, although I do think we're going to hear from him eventually, in fact, pretty soon. It's just that we won't hear from him before the acquittal vote occurs. He has this book that is pending publication. Obviously, he's fighting with the White House about his ability to publish it. Rich, I'm just wondering what you think about the extent to which further revelations matter here. Once we know exactly what's in Bolton's book, I assume Bolton's going to go on a book tour, so he'll have to make some public comments in addition to what's in the book. We're likely to see more documents and recordings related to Lev Parnas. Are there risks here that, you know, Republicans basically don't know what they have decided to tolerate here? I mean, they know the broad strokes, and they've decided, as Lamar Alexander said, that, you know, it's inappropriate for a president to use government funds for these purposes, it's not impeachable. There are other specifics that could be learned in the future, including about these, you know, these business associates of the president's and of Rudy Giuliani's, which, you know, who knows what might be learned that Republicans have tolerated mm-hmm. without realizing that they were tolerating it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would say Lamar's position kind of inoculates you against further revelations and whatever Bolton is going to say, because he's just like, we know this happened, and we can learn, you know, fill in some more of the details, but we basically know in broad gauge what happened, it was wrong. And then sort of the Ted Cruz position, which is this was great and you should have investigated this, you know, is also, you get inoculation kind of on the other end. The senators and, you know, the White House defense, basically, this hasn't been proven or it didn't happen. That's really vulnerable to further revelations. And I think the logical consequence of the Lamar position, again, which I share, is if it's inappropriate, It's good to know more about it. It's good for it to be investigated. It's good for it to be condemned. So I don't think the president's defense is truthful on much of this, and it's a good thing for the truth to come out.
Susan, can you talk a little bit about what legal restrictions John Bolton might be facing? The White House sent him a letter basically saying that the manuscript that he had turned in for review for classified material, in fact, contains a significant amount of top secret material, therefore the book needs to be changed. And his lawyer wrote back saying that that's not true and there's no reasonable way to conclude that things in this book are top secret. What roadblocks is Bolton going to face along the way toward telling his story publicly? And is that likely a reason that he would have wanted to testify here, that being subpoenaed and compelled to tell Congress about what happened would have allowed him to say things that the White House might effectively prevent him from telling the public over the next several months?
Yeah, so clearly the Bolton's intention to publish this book is motivating at least some of his actions, although the timing is a little bit peculiar, right? So John Bolton early on over the past several weeks has said that he wanted to testify, that he intended to comply with a subpoena if the Senate did issue a subpoena to him. Then it appears that the timing appears to be that the White House sent a letter responding to his pre-publication submission identifying that they believed there was classified information in the book and essentially saying they were going to spend more time before they gave him sort of final guidance on how to remediate that. At that point, somebody, I guess we don't know who, although a cynic might suspect John Bolton, leaked these initial information, this sort of the disclosures that raised the question of whether or not Bolton was going to be called or not, which Bolton said, you know, that basically he is the witness that can speak to the direct quid pro quo. So it does appear that at least the disclosure of that information was motivated. I think it's important for people to understand a few things about sort of pre-publication review and non-disclosure agreements. So anyone who has access to classified information has an obligation to keep that classified information safe and not disclose it. And if you don't do that, then you can be criminally prosecuted. And that obligation exists kind of no matter what else is going on. When you get your clearance, you also sign a contract that's essentially a non-disclosure agreement. And one of the things that you're in a contractual agreement with the government over is that you say, hey, if I write a book or I write an article or any sort of printed material, I'm going to give it to you in advance and you can take a look at it to make sure that there isn't classified information here. And it's actually a system that both protects former government employees and also protects the government, right? It's the way to sort of get the check if there's nothing classified here. So John Bolton does have an obligation to undergo this process. I think whatever his lawyers are suggesting that they did this out of an abundance of caution and they didn't have an obligation, you know, that's just ridiculous. That said, pre-publication review requires requirements only apply to manuscripts, to written words. There's nothing that prevents John Bolton from sitting down and having a conversation with you and I about what happened, about the same material. Now, he still has an obligation not to disclose classified information, but sort of this this procedural requirement just doesn't apply to that. And so that's why I do think it'll be interesting to see how John Bolton plays the next several days, because, of course, the ideal outcome might have, for him might have been if he was called to testify, made all of these disclosures publicly such that they couldn't be considered classified information any longer, thus depriving the White House of the ability to prevent publication of this book. Instead, it appears that he played some games, and I would speculate in order to boost book sales. And that does allow the White House now to cause quite a bit of mischief and even prevent the book from coming out in total, if that's what it wanted to do.
Liz, the president who hired John Bolton to be national security advisor has been sharply critical of Bolton on Twitter this week, including saying that Bolton would have started World War VI if Donald Trump had given him the chance to do so. Now, obviously, if Bolton's so terrible, that once again calls in the president's personnel judgment. But I think, it gets at a similar disconnect to what we were talking about at the top of the segment, which is to say what's really important here. One thing that conservatives have pointed out repeatedly is that the military aid to Ukraine that Democrats are complaining that the president did not disperse, many of them had opposed it. They had voted against it. They didn't want to sell so many weapons to Ukraine. And so I guess it again gets at the question of what's the really important thing here? Is it that the president violated the Impoundment Control Act and didn't give military aid to Ukraine that he was legally supposed to and the Congress had decided that he was supposed to? Or are Democrats in a weird position of basically demanding the sale of arms to Ukraine?
Democrats are trying to thread the needle a bit on saying it's not about the specific aid that was due to Ukraine. It's about Trump applying pressure vis-a-vis that aid to assist him with his political goals. And I understand the distinction, but it's a legalistic distinction. And I think it's one that is going to make the most sense to people who have minds sort of trained by things like academic debate and the legal world. And it's not going to be as clear or as interesting to sort of ordinary voters. So I do think there is a likelihood that this is going to be read as the Democrats are angry that Trump was trying to get Biden in trouble and that he wasn't giving weapons to Ukraine, which, you know, is maybe not how I would want that to register. But again, instead of trying to dive into what Trump did and why specifically we should be angry about it for these highly procedural reasons that seem divorced from the substance in some respects of what was going on, why not just lay out our foreign policy in the context of the election that's happening now? If the conversation becomes, Democrats feel like if Congress votes on rendering military aid to Ukraine, then we are obligated to honor our commitments and not violate the law and then render the aid to Ukraine, even though we don't necessarily feel like we ought to be rendering as much aid to Ukraine, that shouldn't be the story. The story on foreign policy on the left should be something completely different.
Rich, what do you make of the president's turn against John Bolton and supporters of the president accusing John Bolton of being a rhino deep state actor? Has John Bolton conducted himself appropriately through this process?
Well, I'm friends with John, so take what I say with a grain of salt. I think the legitimate criticism is, why are you writing a book and why are you publishing it in an election year? The idea that Bolton is going to make stuff up to make himself look better or to shiv the president is completely ridiculous. The problem John has is he's an unvarnished truth teller to a fault. So it may be, there's some legitimate he said, he said's where he remembers something different than acting chief of staff Mick Mulvaney does or something like that. But he'll clearly be rendering his best version of events, and this shows one of the worst aspects of Trump is he'll turn on people on a dime, and all his supporters will as well. So someone who is conservative and good standing as the day before yesterday, if he gets on the wrong side of Trump, will have incredible vitriol thrown at him on TV and on Twitter.
I think we can leave that there on impeachment, and I suspect that we will be hearing more from John Bolton over the next few weeks and months. Susan Hennessy of the Brookings Institution and Lawfare blog, she has written a new book with Benjamin Wittes called Unmaking the Presidency. Susan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
One more note before we go to break. On last week's show, when we were discussing the trade of witness testimony that was being discussed in the Senate, Hunter Biden for John Bolton or something like that, I mistakenly said Hunter Biden was named to the Amtrak board when his father was vice president. In fact, Hunter was named to the board in 2006 when George W. Bush was president and Joe Biden was a senator. I regret the error. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times to talk with Paul Krugman about arguing with zombies. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. And we're joined now by Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize-winning economist and also a columnist at the New York Times. Hello, Paul.
Hi there.
So your new book is called Arguing with Zombies, Economics, Politics, and the Fight for a Better Future. Who are the zombies?
Okay, the zombies aren't people. They're ideas. A zombie idea... I wish I'd invented the phrase. I did steal it. A zombie idea is an idea that should have been killed by evidence, but just somehow keeps shambling along, eating people's brains. And there's a lot of those in America these days.
And so I assume a lot of this has to do with economic policy and ideas about spending and deficits. What do you see as the key zombies that you're in a position of arguing with?
Well, the biggest zombie is the claim that tax cuts pay for themselves. That's the one that has been... tried again and again in practice, never happens, never works, and it still keeps on being cited. In fact, its grip on the mind of the Republican Party has gotten only stronger over the years as the policy failures accumulate. But there are others. The idea that that when there's a recession and the private sector isn't spending, that the government should tighten its belt too. That's a zombie idea that showed surprising power during the financial crisis. There's lots more. Fighting climate change that will destroy the economy. Anyway, many different things, but there's a common thread, and zombie ideas are a big force unfortunately in our discourse.
So, Rich, just this week, Larry Kudlow, who runs the National Economic Council at the White House, said that Trump's tax cuts have already paid for themselves. Republicans, I think it's fair to say, have been in a cul-de-sac on health care policy where they have contradictory talking points against the Affordable Care Act, which mean that they can, bash it as a failure. But when they get together and try to come up with a replacement for it, they're unable to agree on anything. Is Paul Krugman right that conservatives have a basically ideologically bankrupt economic agenda? And have we seen that in the form of exactly which outputs we have and haven't seen from the Trump administration?
No, although I think Paul is right about this talking point that's run out of control about tax cuts paying for themselves, which isn't true. Certain kinds of tax cuts will sometimes not lose as much revenue as they're predicted to because they have growth effects, but it's just not true that tax cuts pay for themselves. So I think that is certainly a zombie talking point. I think on healthcare policy, there is a lot of very good work has been done actually over the last decade by conservative policy types. It just hasn't achieved a consensus within the party because it involves making politically difficult trade-offs, which is a damper on creative thinking and sound policy thinking, I think, on both sides, and it's not a phenomenon unique to Republicans or the right.
And Liz, when I see people on the left look at what they certainly agree with Paul about being zombie ideas on the right, I sense a note of almost jealousy. And so you'll hear things like, well, conservatives and Republicans don't say how they're going to pay for things. So why do we have to say how we're going to pay for things? And so I'm wondering, what do you make of that? Is that a sustainable political approach or a sustainable substantive approach to say that, conservatives were actually onto something and not trying to make their math add up in pushing for things that aren't necessarily sustainable in the long run, but might move them toward their political goals? Should the left be copying some of that?
Well, I think what people are saying on the left when they make that critique is that, the right has a sense of how to campaign on issues. And so, you know, when you look at how right-wingers campaign, they're typically not trying to advance themselves as wonks. They certainly don't have candidates who make a big deal of having personally hammered out and familiarized themselves with the details of every plan they're proposing, because they realize that what actually gets people fired up and interested are the substantive proposals themselves and the moral vision that they're advancing in their politics. That is something that the right is pretty good at and the left could be better at.
I think I'm to the left of your left here because of your left, right, and center. Because I think actually the pay for is Democrats should be willing to talk, to have some plans that will just plain increase the deficit. They don't have to pay for things dollar for dollar. If it's something that's an investment in the future, good sound economics says that you don't necessarily need to be have a revenue source for it. That it you should just think of it as investing, and particularly with borrowing costs so low. There is this real example. Look, Trump's policies have probably increased the deficit by about $300 billion a year relative to what it would have been without his tax cut and a few other things. Think about and with no visible harm, by the way, right? Interest rates haven't spiked or nothing, you know. And think about how different things would look if President Obama had been free to spend $300 billion a year on infrastructure. You know, just think about what the world would look like if progressives were as unconstrained in their ability to pursue their goals as Republicans turn out to be.
Another thing you were worried about right after the election was a loss of Federal Reserve independence. But to the extent that the president has been putting pressure on the Fed, it seems to me like that pressure has been in the right direction, saying that there is, in fact, more slack in the economy, that inflationary pressures are not that strong. There is room for the Fed to keep interest rates lower for longer. I mean, that one big economic question, it feels like he's been on the right side of it, even if his manner in expressing that has been less than ideal.
Yeah, I mean, it turns out that the Fed has been pretty consistently wrong in fearing that inflation was looming, although it is funny that if you do want to bear in mind that the Fed was under constant pressure from Republicans to tighten during the years when we had very high unemployment. And there's this about face as soon as there's a Republican in the White House. But this is, you know, the Fed's errors are not partisan. Trump's push for lower interest rates is not because he has some deep analysis that the economy that's better than the Fed's. It's because he wants you know, everything to go to rip. The question of how low can unemployment go is actually, that's a hard question. It's a question that is nobody can be very sure about, and which means that you can get lucky. I think Trump turns out to have gotten lucky. I'm sure he would have been pushing for the Fed to roll the printing presses regardless. But as it turns out, the state of the economy is such that the Fed is able to roll the printing presses without any ill effects.
And Liz, what do you make of that? I mean, because I think Paul is right that the president is acting here out of his electoral self-interest. But I think that, you know, that presidents want the economy to do well so that they will get reelected is not unique to Trump. And it's a factor that helps presidents make good economic policy because they want policies that will cause people to reelect them. And it makes me wonder if it's any cause to reevaluate the extent to which, you know, providing for ordinary people, providing good economic outcomes for ordinary people, including the relatively strong wage growth that we've been seeing at the bottom of the income scale. You know, Democrats have big theories about how to have the government do this. Elizabeth Warren has all these sort of fine-tuned interventions she wants to make capitalism more friendly to workers. Bernie Sanders wants to collect a bunch of new taxes to spend on government programs that are supposed to better people's individual situations. It feels like the president has a plausible case here that basically by pushing for relatively easy monetary policy and running bigger deficits and cutting taxes, that he sit on a formula that, you know, at least has allowed the recovery to move in a direction that has been better for ordinary workers.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons that the economy has sped up since Trump has been in office. But I think that, you know, there's a way for Democrats to take satisfaction with the economy as it occurs. And there are still those who are concerned about the economy or gloomy on it. And a lot of people, I think, I think you could reasonably say traumatized still by 2008 and still feel quite insecure. even when the economy is doing well, because they're aware of this pattern of booms and busts, and they find it difficult to predict when they might occur. But I think that Democrats would be wise to say, yes, look, the economy is doing well. We're a very rich country. So why is it that if we can produce so much and we can have such a hot economy with people living in, you know, such relative luxury, then why can't everyone have health care? Why should there be any unevenness in distribution there?
Rich, I want to know what you make of an observation that Paul made, basically, that, you know, what the president has been saying about the Federal Reserve and interest rates is just 180 degrees different from the way that Republicans talked about the Federal Reserve during the Obama administration, saying, you know, that you're printing money, you're going to cause rampant inflation, the bubble in asset prices is just a total fake economy, blah, blah, blah. You're not hearing those talking points anymore. And indeed, Judy Shelton, who the president wishes to put on the Federal Reserve Board, is someone who said those sorts of things a few years ago and has now just completely whipped around to the president. View on this. Similarly, the Republicans were very worried about budget deficits until there was a Republican president. And even if they don't claim to like the president's policies that have driven up budget deficits and claim that they would like the president to have cut spending more than he has, they have provided him the legislative support needed to pursue this large deficit policy. I guess the question is, have Republicans learned anything? Have they changed their views? Is there something that Donald Trump was right about that they weren't right about that they're adopting from him? Or, as Paul says, is this a purely cynical thing where, you know, they're day one when a Democratic president comes in, what you're going to hear from Republicans again is deficits are terrible. We need to cut the deficit and the Federal Reserve needs to raise interest rates because there's a specter of inflation.
I think some element of it is clearly partisan hypocrisy. And Republicans were wrong to be so obsessed about the deficit in the Obama years. I plead guilty to some extent of that as well, although I thought the absence of any other agenda except for complaining about the debt was ridiculous and said so at the time. And most conservatives were wrong about the Fed. And I think there are some folks who've legitimately learned their lesson. I think Larry Kudlow, you mentioned earlier, just admits, I was wrong, and has changed his view. And there's nothing wrong with that. You should be open to new evidence. And on the deficit, you know, the long-time traditional fear, right, was that interest rates would spike and inflation would increase, and it hasn't happened. So people should take that on board. I still think there are costs to it that aren't catastrophic, that, you know, are worrisome, and it's imprudent to be running a trillion-dollar deficit and the economy this good. But Washington isn't good at dealing with things that are imprudent. It can only deal with urgent crises. So this is going to just rumble on.
Can I point out, by the way, the interesting asymmetry? Have the Democrats suddenly decide that deficits are evil and terrible and the Fed should raise interest rates now that there's a Republican in the White House? And they have not. So it's that the parties are not the same. Democrats' views about macroeconomics have stayed pretty much the same under Trump as they were before. It's only one party that does 180s on its policy views depending on who sits in the White House. And that's a very important it's an uncomfortable thing. It's not something that political reporters like to acknowledge, but there really is a big difference between the parties on these things.
So what do you do about that? I mean, I assume you don't think that the Democrats ought to opportunistically change their positions on this, that it wouldn't be productive to copy the Republicans there. So what do you do if you're having to argue with zombies all the time?
Well, I think you have to, you know, first of all, you have to just win elections. And arguing with zombies is probably not going to move a lot of votes directly. It's more of a guide to what you do if you win an election. Maybe some sense of the character of the people you're dealing with rather than, you know, arguing macroeconomics on the campaign trail. But I think coming back to where we were starting, there is a really strong case that says that if and when Democrats are in a position to make policy again, they have to be less eat your spinach and more here's good stuff we can do.
Paul Krugman, economist and columnist at The New York Times. His new book is called Arguing with Zombies: Economics, Politics, and the Fight for a Better Future. Paul, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The New York Times and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Juliet Kayyem to talk about the Wuhan coronavirus. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist of the New York Times. The State Department has issued a Level 4 travel warning for China. Level 4 is the sort of travel warning the State Department has for Afghanistan and Syria. It means do not travel there. The warning regards the still-growing outbreak of Wuhan coronavirus, which, as of Friday, has sickened almost 10,000 people and led to more than 200 deaths in China. The State Department has been arranging charter flights to repatriate Americans stuck in Hubei Province, the center of the outbreak. Meanwhile, U.S. airlines have been sharply reducing their flight schedules to and from China, in Delta's case, scrapping the whole China schedule as of February 6. So how well is our government handling this matter? To discuss that, Juliette Kayyem joins us now. Juliette is a former Department of Homeland Security official, and she's a CNN national security analyst. Hello, Juliette.
Hello, Josh.
So how is the Trump administration handling this?
So you have to put the Trump administration sort of in the context of what's going on globally. Today we've really been in defensive posture because we don't know a lot of what's going on with the virus. And of course, the World Health Organization sort of takes the lead in issues like that. So where we are right now is yesterday, the WHO declared this what's called a public health emergency of international concern. And so at that moment is really when it begins to impact the United States as a sovereign country. Basically, the WHO's declaration requires sort of duty to disclose, notification, other sort of what we call situational awareness requirements, urges member nations to surge resources to basically ground zero, and other sort of governance aspects. So that is ongoing, that sort of, tested and planned. And so then the question is, what do we do here in the United States? And, we're not starting today. And so a lot of people like me who've been looking at what the Trump administration has been doing to pandemic preparedness or public health preparedness have been dismayed well before this outbreak. At the NSC, John Bolton and Donald Trump disbanded the pandemic preparedness office, everyone in it. The Homeland Security advisor role has been demoted. Funding for CDC and preparedness on the state and local level has been underfunded in comparative years. And so we're already starting sort of chaotic's a little strong, but we're already starting sort of, not where we ought to be. And then you just have to add on this White House. I'll just be honest with you. The president has yet to appoint person in the White House. He has a committee of 12 plus people. That's not a great management mechanism, and is really putting a lot of the burden on HHS and Secretary Azar to sort of lead this effort. And that historically that hasn't worked really well, only because something of this nature is really going to require sort of White House focus. And when you spend 3 years sort of dismantling the bureaucracy that exists to support the potential of a pandemic, you're going to be in panic mode.
I'm in panic mode.
Let me go back to that.
I have a 6 month old a 3.5 year old, and I'm cognizant that while it seems like young healthy adults are doing okay,
yes,
with this illness, the young and the elderly and people with pre-existing conditions seem to be suffering quite a bit. So I'm worried. Yes. DC is an international city. Should I be panicking, and to what degree?
Yeah, so panic, no, we're not there yet. And just to make it clear, and people like me, who are not doctors, have to follow the science and medicine at this stage. I always say that a crisis has two parts. It has the brain and the muscles. The brain is the doctors trying to figure out, not only sort of how is this being transmitted, what are the best ways to protect ourselves, what are the best sort of mechanisms that we have to follow. And that might lead to what you might call the muscle response, which is things that you're starting to see, travel bans, social distancing, face masks in areas that may need it. For the United States, listen to my voice. I am not in panic mode. I'm in concern mode, only because this is what we call a slow roll crisis. It's coming. There will be more than 5 or 6 Americans impacted by it. We know that. We also don't know a lot about how this is sort of being, you know, sort of, you know, transferred from patient to patient, we are seeing asymptomatic contagion, which is sort of rare. That means that you are sort of, you know, harming your spouse, so to speak, before you even know that you have the virus. And that's sort of unique. So there are aspects to this that are concerning, but just looking at the numbers and looking at the focus, we are not even close to crisis stage. And if anything, the crisis really should be, you know, are we prepared for more coming? And that requires education on the state and local level, education to the population, travel bans that we're starting to see, but also how much are we willing as a country to play offense? So in the past, in these kinds of instances, and remember Ebola under President Obama, you know, basically, you know, we might have viewed it as altruistic to help African nations suffering from Ebola, but it was also self-preservation. We wanted to stop an Ebola outbreak at the source. You're not hearing much by the administration about sort of the surging of resources and to help our, you know, to help China and our Asian friends and allies. In fact, you know, the worst of it is you at least heard, you know, the Secretary of Commerce sort of suggest that, you know, the way they're looking at it is you know, potentially an economic boom. Let me just make this clear. A global pandemic will not be an economic boom for anyone except for maybe, you know, the makers of surgical masks and, you know, I hate to be morbid about it, but, you know, people in the death industry. It is not, because people stop spending money, they stop traveling, and our supply chain slows down. That's bad for any economy.
To what extent do we want things like travel bans? I mean, both there have been things internally, and then there have been questions about should U.S. airlines stop serving China. On the flip side, you have these charter flights that the State Department is arranging, bringing people directly from Hubei province to San Francisco. Is that a good idea? And do we have appropriate measures to ensure that that doesn't, you know, that doesn't encourage the spread of the epidemic in the U.S.?
Right. So travel bans are really tricky. And so to the layperson, it may be, this seems so obvious to us to, you know, keep the Chinese, you know, in China. So it's just, I'd be honest, as a non-doctor, it's taken me a while to sort of get my head around this because it seems so obvious. The truth is just what we know now is that unfortunately probably is too late, that the restrictions that we're seeing from areas in China are probably smart, those travel restrictions, but these broad bans that you're starting to see are unlikely to sort of significantly change things. And the reason why, and this is where you got to get your head around this, is because one, it's already here, but two, the urging. One of the reasons why the WHO was so insistent yesterday when it declared this emergency was to not do travel bans. Historically, they haven't worked for contagions. And secondly, what they do is they have countries go underground. In other words, they're less likely to give information about what is happening in their country, and therefore so that they won't be impacted by future travel bans. And so you're just weighing really difficult choices at this stage. And there are some people who will say, well, better, you know, better safe than sorry. But, you know, given that what we don't know about what's going on in terms of the medical scientific side, there are others who say, you know, it's just a big debate, who say, look, if you do this, every country is going underground, and we may have a global pandemic, and no one will know it because countries are not leaning in terms of notification. That's the balance the WHO is dealing with. Is there a right answer? It's just really hard to know in real time what the right answer is at this stage. I will say one thing, Josh, from an economic perspective or business perspective, some of the things that you're seeing are, you know, industries and companies specifically deciding on their own what their protocols will be. So you're seeing airlines making decisions based on likely their sort of own threat assessment, but my guess is also their employees, that you probably have, you know, flight attendants and others and pilots saying, we're not going to go into China. You're going to get the same with TSA and Customs and Border Protection workers. You know, so you will get sort of, what do I say, not randomness, but, you know, sort of these decisions being made on a case-by-case basis.
And what do you make about those charter flights?
So on the charter flights, it was such a particular group of people in the zone who we sort of have an obligation to get out because they are in Wuhan. They are our citizens, and they are such a particular group of people. They're being monitored and isolated. I think it's probably the right thing to do since most of them are American U.S. employees. You want to, it's no different than a war zone. You just want to get them out. It's just the nature of contagion that they're going to have to be isolated for some period of time. They are in an area where, let me do the good news now, right? So there are specific areas that are of extreme concern because of what's happening with their populations. There have been no deaths in the United States. We are, if you get to it early, it looks like people can survive. It's hitting elderly men and not young children. Those are always good things. I hate to say that. And we're going to learn more about, you know, how it's spreading. The cases that we've seen so far have been, in terms of spreading, of asymptomatic patients have been spouses or coworkers. Those are people in close confined areas where either the spouse or the coworker had actually been in Wuhan. So, you know, this is why we have strong notification protocols, because we just want to find out who's been there and make sure that their family members are protected.
In terms of the fear of countries going underground if we ban travel, I just assume the Chinese government's going to lie no matter what. But I have two specific questions, one regarding U.S. policy and one a little more global. So Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner, co-authored an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying the key thing is obviously keeping patients who might have this isolated and finding out whether they really have it or not. And at the moment, you have to send a sample to the CDC to get them to do a test. And it takes days, which is sort of inefficient. And if you actually see cases multiply, the CDC is going to be overwhelmed. So he says there needs to be some partnership with private entities to develop a more widespread and easily available test. One, do you think that's right? And two, is that plausible? And then with the SARS epidemic in 2002, influenced heavily affected China, that was basically stamped out relatively easily. What happened then, and what are our chances of replicating that experience?
Right. So let me start with SARS. So SARS is a semi-good news story. It impacted particular countries. There were extreme travel bans. And actually, that's a lesson, whatever we think of China right now, that was a lesson for the WHO and China. They were actually in sort of public fights about SARS, about how bad it was. The WHO knew China was lying at that time. You are not really seeing that right now. Now, China will tell you they were too late in sort of recognizing that this was different, that 2000 was different. Actually, you know, 2019 was different. They are well aware that they waited too long. But at least what I'm hearing from the governance perspective is that the Chinese are being more forthright about the indicators, because they know what the economic and personal impact will be globally, you know, let alone what we're starting to see here, which is, of course, you know, concern, you know, the sort of racial and ethnic concerns that always follow something like this. As for Gottlieb, I think he's absolutely right. I mean, I think that, you know, the private sector has been burned in the past. H1N1 is a perfect example where everyone panics. You rush for a vaccine. Was it necessary? Who knows? It was less, you know, less disastrous for this country than your average flu season. But those kinds of partnerships are absolutely necessary. But let even the best of partnerships in terms of identification, flu vaccines, flu distribution, helping out with if we have to build things or whatever else, you are still talking about time delays that are behind some of the best forms of protection, which are, you know, identification and social distancing. That's clearly what's going to happen. We're not going to, in the United States, we're not going to, you know, unless the numbers get, I'm not even going to say that. In the United States, you know, the idea that we're going to quarantine in the way that China has is just not part of our governance system. So what we do is we urge isolation for those who are showing or have been around people who might have been exposed, and second, social distancing. That's going to be the thing that works the best, and it's cheap, and you can educate the public to do that, and people hopefully won't go into a panic. we're not seeing the numbers right here in the United States that we're seeing, you know, in China or other Asian countries.
Juliette Kayyem, former Department of Homeland Security official and national security analyst at CNN. Juliette, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
Now that we're almost at Iowa, you're seeing some of the heavy artillery reserved for Bernie Sanders coming out that he once praised or seemed to praise George Wallace, though a greater context seems to point to the op-ed in which he discussed George Wallace actually having been very critical of him, and that he said that the Vietnam War was almost as bad as what Hitler did. It strikes me that what they're always going after, the Oppo researchers, when they look these pieces up, is evidence that Bernie Sanders has been inconsistent. But the only thing they seem to prove is that he's always been Bernie.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
CNN purports to be a news network, but is really a perpetual anti-Trump outrage machine. The other night, host Don Lemon cracked up over two guests mocking Trump voters when called out on it. Lemon said he hadn't heard what his guests said during his long and uproarious laughter. This is an absurd defense. It's Don Lemon's right to laugh at whatever he wants to on his TV show, but he and his network shouldn't pretend to be something they aren't.
For my rant, the Iowa caucus is coming up, and supporters of Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden both care about winning the general election. They just have very different theories of electability. The Biden theory is that a more moderate candidate will win over swing voters, and the Sanders theory is that a more extreme candidate with an outsider image will activate irregular voters who might not turn out at all or who might vote for a third-party candidate otherwise. The evidence from the 2018 campaign says to me that the first theory is better. Democrats retook the House by nominating moderate candidates, many of them with national security backgrounds, who promised to protect the Obamacare status quo against scary Republican changes to the healthcare system. Candidates who ran on Medicare for All in 2018 ran several points worse than those who opposed it, according to an analysis from Emory political scientist Alan Abramowitz. So that's where I stand. I think Biden is the safer bet. But I will give Bernie this. While I believe his ideological views are an electoral disadvantage, I do buy that his outsider image is an advantage in an election. So if nominated, Bernie should look for ways to play up his outsider cred to voters who are not necessarily leftist, but are skeptical of the establishment. And I think Bernie himself understands his need to do this. It's why his campaign embraced an endorsement from Joe Rogan over substantial objections from progressive groups who have a litany of grievances against the ultra-popular podcaster. A key question for a November campaign with Bernie as the nominee is whether progressives have priced in that Bernie will need to do this, and whether they're willing to watch him do things that Joe Biden wouldn't have to do to build a winning electoral coalition. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, Paul Krugman, Susan Hennessy, and Juliette Kayyem. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director today is Mario Diaz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.